We all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. So pleased to be having you joining us. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. When I think of aircraft that look like a warplane should, several come to mind. The venerable P-51 Mustang, the elegant Mirage 4, or even the stealthy F-22. Some aircraft don't look like planes, but rather like something out of a Buck Rogers comic book. The B-2 Bomber comes to mind. And then there's a plane that looks like both. It's sleek, elegant, fast, even menacing. The SR-71 meets my ideal image of a cool aircraft. She looks like she's flying even while sitting on the tarmac. The Blackbird didn't carry weapons, didn't need to. Her weapons are blazing speed and the ability to fly at altitudes beyond 85,000 feet above the Earth. It's the fastest plane ever built with an airspeed in excess of Mach 3. For those of you who don't do math in public, that's 2,223 miles per hour. That's literally faster than a speeding bullet. The proof in the pudding is the fact that all the years of service, one has never been shot down. They've outrun over 4,000 missiles without a scratch. The SR-71 Blackbird is a special, one-of-a-kind plane, and those who have flown it are also a very special cadre of pilots, the Habus. Today, we're joined by one of only 93 Air Force pilots to have ever flown this technological miracle. He is a highly sought-after public speaker and the author of some of the most popular books ever written on the topic. His hilarious speed check story has been viewed millions of times on the internet, probably not only because it's a great story, but because Brian is a great storyteller. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Major Brian Scholl.
Well, hey, Ben, thanks for having me. It's a real treat to be on your broadcast today.
Get out of here. You're the real pro. I'm just some guy in a garage.
Well, no, you know how to do this stuff. This is, I'm out of my element.
Brian, looking forward to our chat. I'll tell you right now, we don't have enough time. But I shared some little sort of SR-71 factoids in the intro. I'm sure I missed some intriguing ones. Regular listeners know, Brian, that Ben gets at least one or two dumb questions every show. So I'm going to come right out of the hangar with one. The SR-71 gulps air and fuel like a frat boy drinks beer on his 21st birthday. And on the ground, she sweats like that very same frat boy might sweat the day after. When you're firing up those engines, though, in a puddle of fuel, what keeps the whole thing from going up in a ball of flame?
Well, the first easy answer to that would be the fuel is a pretty non-flammable fuel. It has a very high flash point. So you could actually take a bucket of that fuel, throw a match into it. It would extinguish the match. So the real uniqueness of this airplane is that they had to develop and invent technology when they were building it for hydraulics, oil, fuels to withstand the incredible temperatures incurred at those speeds. And I love the way you mentioned menacing and elegant as in the same sentence, because this is the one jet that was precisely that, looked menacing and was elegant at the same time. It was designed to leak. It grew about 4 inches in flight due to the heat of about 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit on the wing leading edge. And that was because they never really could. The one thing that stumped them was building a fuel tank bladder. They never could come up with a material that would work sufficiently. So the fuel tank itself was the aircraft skin, the aircraft. And they found that the aircraft was expanding in flight, cracking the titanium when they first developed it. So they built expansion joints into the aircraft. Thus, the leaking, it's kind of messy.
Yeah.
You will never see a picture of it on the ramp without the mandatory puddle underneath. But it was pretty non-flammable in that sense as a hazard.
You know, Brian, one thing I always look back with in amazement when you think about aircraft, when you think about the space missions and aircraft like the SR-71, this thing was all designed and built with slide rulers.
You know, the real amazing part of the story is that this airplane should have never been built. It was because men like Ben Rich and Kelly Johnson had a vision that they just weren't going to let go of, and they just had to figure out a way to do it. I always refer to it as that 57 Chevy, and it was just built solid. It did what they said it would do, and it did it better than any other airplane for a quarter of a century. It's a miraculous construction in so many ways with that ancient technology. Yes, slide rules and just round gauges and pretty ancient electrical systems, but it worked.
Brian, one of the things it was built for was to keep an eye on our friends, the Soviets. When I don't know if you ever flew any missions over there, and you probably can't share, but I find it deliciously ironic that we built this plane. We didn't have enough titanium, so we set up secret companies to buy titaniums from the Russians to build the plane we're going to use to spy on them.
We actually did. They set up a fake company there, an import company, and they got all their titanium from Russia. And it was kind of one of the great ironies of the program.
Okay, now here is my second and probably not last dumb question. I'm no Lockheed engineer with a slide ruler, but why on earth would you put a rearview mirror on the world's fastest airplane? It's not like everybody's going to sneak up behind you, right?
You know, all the jets in the 50s and 60s were just automatically, they just had rearview mirrors in them. But I'll tell you why they were very handy. When you're sitting in that airplane, in that spacesuit, and you need to see yourself for finding that little hole in the spacesuit where the water bottle goes, or to check your own equipment, it was real handy to have a mirror in there. Certainly, we weren't using it to look to the rear of the aircraft. We actually had a little periscope built into the roof of the canopy that we could pop up to look back over the rudders to make sure they were aligned and trimmed and everything. So, yeah, it's kind of funny, but they're in there.
It's got a purpose. Now, all the Blackbirds were two-seaters? I mean, by design, right? There was never a one-seater?
Well, when they first built the airplane, it really was, you know, the YF-12, A-12. It was really built to be an interceptor, and they did have some single-seat versions of that. And eventually, they found out it was quite a workload, you know, for the pilot and everything. And when they then developed, the Air Force said they were going to buy all these interceptors, and they didn't, because the threat went from bombers to missiles. ICBMs became the bigger threat than Russian bombers flying over the polar ice cap. So once you put that second seat in there for the reconnaissance version, it made a lot of sense, and it was really, really necessary because the division of duties was great and very important to have that second man there.
Brian, I mentioned two of the weapons of this amazing aircraft. I neglected to mention the third, and that was its camera. Again, we're probably getting into classified information, but you hear phrases like, you know, I could get a photo of a golf ball on a green from 80,000 feet. They that good, huh?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was a 57 Chevy, but they would mount Star Wars technology as the decades went by. You got newer and better optics and sensors. And absolutely, you could really look at some incredible resolution. And they showed us that a couple times. When you're in training, you get to see some examples of that. Quite impressive. Then you never get to see your film ever again. Your job is to fly the black line, bring the take home, and don't worry about that. We'll download, we'll interpret it and everything. So it was very impressive to see that.
Brian, I'm going to explain to our listeners a little bit more. You know, I teased about that speed check video, and I promised you we're not going to tell that story here. If they want to hear that story, they need to hire you or go to the internet. But to me, the stronger story is the background of how you came to be in the cockpit of the fastest aircraft ever. But one other quick question before we take the break. I read that in order to qualify to be a SR-71 pilot, everyone had to be married. Is that true?
No, I don't know where that came from.
Okay.
Really, I used to hear that about the Thunderbirds, too, and neither one was actually really true. We had several single guys in the squadron, so no, that was not a big sticking point in any sense.
Fair enough. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host. We're talking with Brian Scholl about being an SR-71 pilot. You can learn more, visit SledDriver, SLEDDriver.com. When Brian told his dad he wanted to grow up to be a jet pilot, his dad said, "Sorry, son, you can't do both." We'll hear more about that when we come back. Bye-bye. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller-Garcia. We're joined by Major Brian Scholl. Brian flew, 500 hours in the cockpit of the SR-71, Brian?
Yeah.
Okay. Brian, I saw an interview you did where you teased that just like Elvis had to sing Love Me Tender at every concert, you speak all over the world. And people always demand to hear that speed check story. I promise you we wouldn't do that. But I tell you, not just because I made a promise to you about that, but the story, when I started looking into your background, the story of how you came to be and what you overcame, maybe better put, to become a Blackbird pilot is even more compelling. You flew 212 covert close air support missions in Laos and Cambodia during the Vietnam War. Take us to that fateful day near the Cambodian border, if you will.
Well, I always tell people I'm the least likely guy that would have ever flown the Blackbird, and the luckiest guy in the world to have done all I have done since the day my airplane went down till even today. And I mean that. And I was forced to ride a plane into the jungle there. I was flying AT-28Ds, which was kind of a cool little counterinsurgency plane. And kind of blew up in the crash, and was able to get myself out of the cockpit, which was a miracle in itself. My visors had all melted in my helmet, so I was doing everything blind. It was all that great Air Force training. Ran across the wing and kind of laid out there in the jungle, smoldering. I was pretty numb. I was badly burned, but I was just numb. So it wasn't a matter of intense pain as much as it was I was a little immobile and dehydrated and in shock a little bit, I guess. And very lucky that people, there's no doubt there's a big fireball there and all, and I was real close to one of our forward locations, so they knew where I was and everything. People came, got me out of there, and I was just very lucky, and I quickly medevaced to Okinawa the very next, or that night, and spent 2 months in intensive care there where they said, "Well, you're going to die." They said, "No, you're not going to die. Well, we're going to kind of amputate a couple fingers." "No, we're not going to do that. Now, you're just going to have to build your body back from 119 pounds now." I went from 180 to 119, and then they flew me back to Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and spent about a year in the hospital there going through all these surgeries. And there really was no real path you could see that this man's going to get back in the cockpit of fighter jets and be able to function, especially with the use of his hands and his fingers, and overcome that injury. He'll live. He'll be fine. He can walk again and everything.
Well, but they initially didn't think you. They didn't give you much chance of living, even, Brian. Right.
Well, it looked pretty bad at first, and I think all of the athletics and everything I'd done all my life and just working out, I was only 25 years old. I was real healthy. And the doctor even said, your vital signs never wavered once, even when you went through the most trauma, your body went through the most trauma. So again, I was just very lucky. And it's just a story that you don't believe when you hear all of the twists and miraculous turns to it. You think you're just making it up, and then one day, you pass a physical, you get back to flying, and...
You're being too humble, sir, and I don't want to skip forward too much because I want to talk about that. But before we do that, how long were you on the ground after the crash on your own? I mean, they didn't come and get away.
I was only on the ground less than an hour.
Okay.
About an hour, maybe. Like I said, it was a very difficult place to get to. It took them a little while, but they knew... People were coming, and wasn't that I was out in no man's land, laying there for 12 hours. So I would have been dead.
The folks that came and got you, were they PJs or some other?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was just, like I said, a very fortuitous. Every turn of my story, I have to say, wow, that, you know, it could have gone the other way so easily. I tell people I had 50 rounds of tracer ammunition on my vest with my pistol, and the cockpit was on fire, and none of the ammunition went off or anything. So, wow. I mean, there was 100 stories like that where you could have easily ensured you would never fly again by just some little misstep, or it was just my destiny. We all have different paths in life, and it was just meant to be. I don't take credit. The reason, I'm not trying to sound humble about it. I've come to a great realization in life that I don't take credit for it, because all of the things that happened, we always tend to think we're in control of the universe, but we're really not. So, yes, I had a part. You have to adapt. You have to adjust to what happens in life. But I really feel like it was just my destiny that was the way it was going to be. If you put the effort in, and you don't know how much you can really do. And that one of the big messages of my talks are, you don't know how much you can do till you really put in the effort. There was there's no guarantees in life. Mm-hmm. There's none. So. My story is not one of, ooh, look at me, I'm tough, I'm brave, I was courageous. It's like, you know, I learned a whole lot. I was pretty much a big baby there in the hospital, crying and screaming and cursing my attendants.
Well, and Brian, we'll get to that, that part, because that's but I just want to say, you know, asking me who my favorite guests are is kind of like asking, a parent who their favorite child is. It's for today, you're my favorite guest. But let's just say that the Pararescue, the PJs, are some of my other favorites. And just real quick, keeping in mind it's a family show, Brian, share with folks what happened. That last rescue helicopter was coming in, and the pilot's like, I don't think we can land there. And share with our listeners what that PJ told the pilot.
Well, yeah, there was it was pretty inaccessible area, and they didn't think they could put the chopper down without, you know, enough rotor clearance. And the guys were on the ground were like, this guy's going to die if we don't get him out. We can't keep moving him around. It's real tough terrain. And I remember one of the guys pointing his weapon at the helicopter saying, if you either put it down or we'll shoot it down, kind of thing. And I thought, boy, I'm definitely on the right team of players today. And I felt pretty good. I was very, very conscious and very alert and very aware of everything that was going on. Again, I was in kind of shock, but I was numb. I wasn't like screaming in pain. Hmm. I realized my arms were pretty much charred and burned off, but I just didn't look at them. And people say, do you remember? Did you black out? I said, I wished I could have blacked out, but I remember everything. It's like things moved in slow motion.
Hmm. Well, let's fast forward now. So you go from this guy's not even going to live to, okay, he's going to live, but he's never going to fly again. I don't know how many surgeries, all kinds of surgeries. You're in the hospital, intensive care, in and out. And you say, no, I want to fly again. And what was there a moment, Brian, where you transitioned from it hurts too much, you know, Lord, just make it be over, to know, you know what, there's a reason I'm still here, let's make a go of it?
Well, as I say in my talks, I actually wanted to die there in Okinawa and said, I can't do this. I had a lot of talks with God every night. You picked the wrong guy. Mm-hmm. I was pretty tough, but at 119 and a half, I just can't keep doing this every day. And I just remember one day seeing the kids out that third floor window playing soccer out in the soccer field there at Kadena from that hospital window. And, you know, hearing Judy Garland sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow on the radio, and you just, it wasn't like just some moment where, oh, I heard a song and now all of a sudden I'm rejuvenated. It's just that it reminded me of I was those kids out there playing kickball, and I wanted to build model airplanes and fly jets and everything. I thought, you know, okay, you're probably going to never fly again. You may even die, but just the attitude, the big issue with me was just change your attitude and go out fighting, at least have some dignity to your own brain instead of just quitting. And I thought, okay, I had accepted. I would probably never fly again, probably wouldn't have much of a life again, but I would just go out with a positive attitude. And that's where I really learned a lot about attitudes, everything in life. One of my pillars of my talks, I preach, attitudes, everything. And as soon as I turned that corner and had that attitude, boy, it's amazing all the things that happened. Now, it didn't mean it was easy. Didn't mean it was all automatically great or guaranteed. It just meant that was your only hope of going in that direction, was to change that attitude. And it was a great lesson, and that stayed with me to this day. You can talk yourself out of things, and you can also, you're as great as you think you are, and you're can do as much as you think you can do. And it was a great turning point for me. So I had nothing to lose. I thought, well, let's do the therapy and just see. Maybe I'll get the use of my fingers back. And I did. Was it painful? Did I dread the therapist? Yeah. And yet, when you have a goal and you have a reason, it's all part of the process. And you go like, well, at least there's some purpose to this. And if I don't ever get to fly, at least I'll get to use my fingers again to have a life. So it was positive. You were moving forward. And that was a big difference besides lying there whimpering and watching your hands decay into a stiff ball of immobility. Brian, and I saw people do that. I did. I saw it.
When we come back, I want to pursue that a little bit more too, and also, you know, tell some stories. We have some folks that tune in to hear the stories, but let me just leave this teaser before we take a break. So Brian decides he wants to fly again. The Air Force is not too excited about that idea, given that you augured one of their planes in already. But they sent a special colonel to visit you in the hospital to try and straighten you out. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. More with Major Brian Scholl, the sled driver, when we come back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Major Brian Scholl. You can learn more, visit sleddriver.com, SLED driver.com. Brian, when we last left our hero, he was in a hospital bed looking to make a comeback. And then one day a colonel in dress blues walks in the door and the challenge glove was thrown down, wasn't it?
That day for me, I wasn't trying to make a comeback. I was trying to survive. But always in the back of your mind, you thought, well, let's see how far I could go. To be honest, I was pretty sure I would probably never pass a flight physical. But I didn't allow myself to just sink into some depression about that. But what happened was the Air Force kept sending me all these discharge papers that I refused to sign because, to me, it was just a mental symbol of giving up. I didn't really care about their administrative problems over it, but they were not too happy with I wasn't filling out any of the paperwork for discharge. Anyway, one day a man in Air Force blue uniform stood right there beside my bed and was standing next to my primary surgeon. And I go, uh-oh, looks like the Air Force has come to arrest me or give me a lecture or something about. And I go like, well, who are you? And he said, well, I just wanted to come see who this guy, this lieutenant was that hadn't signed his papers and what the deal was up here. And he said, I'm the chief flight surgeon of the entire Air Force. And if you think you can pass a physical someday, you come across town, Randolph Air Force Base, and I will give it to you personally. And if I do it, nobody will question it. But I'll be hard on you and give you a full two-day thing. And I thought, wow, why would you do that for me? I don't know you. And he said, well, I like your attitude. He said, I just like your attitude. And I don't know the man. And a few months later, after several other surgeries, I was still pretty underweight and weak, but they put me in the ambulance, took me over there to Randolph Air Force Base across town in San Antonio there. And we did a two-day full physical of everything. And he said, you know, internally, you have had no injuries. Everything internally is perfect. You look like hell on the outside. He said, and we just have some doubt about a couple of fingers here and all. So I was able to do his little finger tests. And he says, I'm trying to flunk you, but I can't. So we're going to put you up in a T-38 tomorrow in the back seat and let a guy take you up to make sure there's no adverse. And that was just a gift. That was a joyride. And he signed it, a 1A, no waiver. So here I come back to the Air Force flying to fly, and I look like I've been run over by a truck. And they go like, 1A, no waivers. What the hell?
Now, Brad, are you maybe the first guy to ever show up for his military physical in the back of an ambulance?
I don't know, but I'll tell you, I I thought this is just too surreal. This can't possibly be happening. And that's one of the many miracles I always say along the way that happened. And I subscribe to the motto my mom taught me one day. She said, we don't believe in miracles. We count on them. And boy, I'll tell you, it sounded trite at the time, but that's a very serious thing to me today after looking back at all the events and all the serendipitous and surreal things that happened that put you in the cockpit of the world's fastest jet. It's hard for me to believe.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is exactly why I wanted this fellow on the show. And please visit sleddriver.com and hear more about his story. So, Brian, the other thing that's intriguing to me is you've flown the fastest aircraft in the world. And when you got out, you got back into the cockpit, you started flying again. Then you were also assigned to what could arguably be called the slowest airplane in the world, the A-10. Really, was that, if you look back on it, from flying low and slow and to faster than a speeding bullet, would you ever think of that and go, that's quite a leap?
You said I was your favorite guest because I'm the one that's on now. You know, your favorite airplane is the one you're flying at the time.
Okay.
And I was lucky enough to get to fly the A-7, and then I was in the first A-10 squadron. And, yeah, it was a little slower. We're doing barely 300 knots. And I used to tell people, you know, I started in T-28s, that I went from 200 knots to 2,000 knots. So I had quite a full spectrum. But I will tell you, you learn a lot more about flying and pilotage and aviation skills when you're flying low and slow and you have to do a lot of navigation on your own and everything. You just learn more. Flying the SR-71 was the greatest thing, but you know, it's not the same as really doing a lot of things you're doing when you're low and slow. So they all had their attraction and they all had you had your own love for them when you were flying different airplanes. And it was really pretty cool to be in the very first A-10 squadron and go out there, write your name in the desert with that gun. And, but, I was the first A-10 guy to come to the SR-71 and, it was a different environment. Yes, sir.
Well, now, weren't you part of the first, A-10 demonstration team as well, Brian?
Yeah, when we had 12 jets at Myrtle Beach, we were the first operational squadron there, and the commander and the ops officer said, you're going to draw up some sort of air show thing. You're going to be our narrator. We're going to fly. We got to show the Army what this airplane can do. So we just made up stuff, and the airplane couldn't do too much. It was a little underpowered as far, but it was just impressive. Whenever we'd fire the gun, the Army just fell in love with it, you know, and the Marines, they loved it. So. Then I got to do air shows for a number of years, the Cleveland National Air Show, Akron Air Show, all over the Southwest, and it was just a great time. So even though the airplane had a lot of shortcomings, I don't look back on it as it was some negative thing. You make the most of it, and that airplane's still around. It did a pretty good job in the Middle East. So,
yeah, it's another one of those planes that's doing exactly what she was designed to do, kind of like the SR-71.
Yeah, and, you know, airplanes come and go. I always say the SR-71 was the most remarkable aircraft of the 20th century because of how it was built, what it did, and how long it did it, and the fact that it still holds its records in 2020. So there's a lot of amazing airplanes that have been come and gone. We just retired not too long ago, the 747, pretty impressive airplane in its day when it first came out. So I'm really happy I got to fly a number of different airplanes in the Air Force and spend 20 years in the cockpit. I never had to sit behind a desk, which is kind of hard to do, but it can be done.
Brian, I tell you, I want to wrap up the show here after this next break with some of the things you've learned throughout the course of your experiences, because they really do apply. They don't just apply to a fighter pilot. They can apply to all us. And I told you, we're not going to do the speed check story. And also, as much as I'm tempted, I'm not going to have you tell the slowest flyby by an SR-71 in history story either.
I'd have to come right over there and choke you if you did that.
But you did, you know, I talked about the exceptional characteristics of the SR-71 and its ability to outfly threats. And coming a little bit closer to modern day, you actually had a chance to practice that over Libya, right?
My backseater and I were the only SR crew that flew three missions in 3 days during the Libyan crisis in 86 there over the Mediterranean. So, yeah, we had a couple of missiles fired at us, and it was a pretty exciting time. My second book is all about that, The Untouchables, which is a kind of a companion volume to Sled Driver, but most people don't know much about it because Sled Driver is like the sun and The Untouchables like Mercury. But it's really an engaging story of now that the jet's declassified, we can tell you all we're really doing. But the airplane was did everything they said it would do, and very tough to shoot down, a tough target at that speed. And if you just make a turn or anything, it's really tough on the missile to recalibrate a 30-mile lead point. So it eventually burns out fuel and falls back to the earth. So.
Brian, I tell you, one of my hard and fast rules that I've broken for you, I'm breaking all kinds of rules for you today, Brian, and that's okay. You know, I always read an author's book before they come on the show, and you've published four, I think maybe five books. I wanted to get a copy of Sled Driver, but it's $320 on Amazon. Untouchables, $170 on Amazon. You're doing pretty good. I mean, your books.
You're going the wrong place.
Okay. I should buy them at sleddriver.com, maybe.
Go to sleddriver.com. All those people are gouging. It is an expensive book, but when you see the book and you see how it's put together, it's a real showcase piece for Coffee Table. We didn't cut any corners on it, and we've never had one returned.
Did you see what I did there? I threw up that softball, and you knocked it right out of the park.
You did very well.
Ben. You were not so kind to Walter, as I recall, on that Libyan mission, because, you know, you're getting alerts, missiles coming up to chase you, and what you tell Walter, hey, if we do get shot down, just remember, I'm just the pilot, you're the spy. You threw him right under the bus. Yeah.
No. Walt's a great guy. We're best friends to this day, and couldn't have done it all without him. It was a two-man job in there, and you hear all about the pilots. You talk to the pilots, but those guys in the back seat, I'll tell you what, they were doing the heart of the mission, and it was real critical. They couldn't fly the airplane, but there's no stick, but they were navigating and taking the pictures and monitoring threats. I'll tell you, I have a lot of respect for them. We're just, like I say, best friends to this day.
Brian, when we come back, I want to talk some more about those lessons learned. The one thing I love about your Libyan story, though, is you describe this aircraft as lovingly as a jockey would describe a thoroughbred. I mean, you weren't piloting the plane. It was almost like a symbiotic effort. I mean, you feel the plane, and this plane, it was like a horse. It just wanted to run, right? But these, like a good horse, sometimes maybe this plane would actually go faster than it was good for its own good, right?
Yeah, you had to rein her in sometimes. She loved the speed. She loved being out there.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. Wonderful, wonderful chat with Major Brian Scholl. It's going to get even better in the interim. No, don't leave us. Listen to our advertisers, but you can also visit sleddriver.com to find out more about this just wonderful individual. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're having a peach of a chat with Major Brian Scholl. You can learn more about him. Look up sleddriver.com. Brian, you also have a wonderful photo gallery or a photo studio. Is that, what's the website for that, Brian?
Well, we are Gallery One.
Okay.
Here in Marysville, where it's a gallery of my photographic work and everything. But the best to get to it, it's best to go through sleddriver.com. But you can go to Gallery One, and eventually we're going to redo the websites to put them all together. And so you can go either into the aviation section or the nature. I do a lot of nature photography now.
Well, and photography, you know, flying planes is clearly a passion for you. Photography is also a passion. Brian, I want to spend the last segment of our show talking about passion and blessings. And let me just start by sharing a story. There is a certain watering hole in my hometown that is frequented by a lot of secret squirrels. I'll just leave it at that. And there was a fellow there, an older gentleman who I think he might have even been involved in perfecting or testing parachutes. I mean, this guy had jumped out a perfectly good aircraft tens of thousands of times, and he and I are sitting there at the bar sharing, you know, having our beers, and I told him, I took statistics three times before I passed, so I consider myself, you know, reasonably intelligent. I said, you know, I've always wanted a parachute. I've always wanted to jump out of a plane, but statistically, just to be safe, I think I'll do it when I'm 98. That way, in case something goes wrong, no big loss. And Brian, you might appreciate this. He kind of nods his head and says, uh-huh. And then without turning to look at me, he just says, but imagine if you waited that long and it turned out you really, really loved it.
Yeah, and good point.
What a revealing moment for me. A lot of what you share with people, Brian, given that you got a second chance at life, really, let's talk about that. Let's talk about how life really is short, and how we shouldn't miss any opportunity that's offered to us, whether it's jumping out of a plane now, Ben, when you're young, or pursuing your passion for photography.
Well, that's very true, and it's the heart of my talks, and it's the most, I think, part I enjoy talking about most. A lot of people enjoy, I put a lot of pictures of the SR-71 in my talks and talk about that, and that truly is interesting and fun. But the real meat of what I want to share with people and want to inspire them is about attitude, perspective, and choices. And it's all about the attitude you have in life and the perspective you keep and the choices you make. Now, that man hit it right on the head with the parachute. You didn't have that perspective. You might have done it and really loved it. And when I went to apply for the SR-71, everyone said, don't do that. If you flunk the astronaut physical, you'll never fly anything anymore. And I said, yeah, but what if I pass it? What if I can do it and I missed it because out of fear? And I have learned in my life that most people don't do things out of fear, and we've all done that. We don't think we're good enough. People laugh at us. I don't know if I can do it or not. And sometimes we miss the greatest opportunities, and life goes by so fast and so quick, and it's all over. Did you do the things you know you wanted? Don't be afraid to do them. So the attitude's everything. It's not about skill, money, and being born into, with some perfection of athletic skills or whatever. It's about applying yourself and then keeping that perspective of how lucky you really are and how on the edge we live every day. Life is a precious thing. And then you have choices as you go through life. Should I take that job? Should I do this? Should I do that? And that's going to form the whole path of your life. So it's really up to you. I think my favorite part of any Hollywood movie line, there's been a lot of great lines coming out of movies, was when Morgan Freeman was God in that movie where he said, you know, people keep asking me for miracles, and I've already given them everything. They can do it all themselves. He said, go be the miracle. He says, you want to see a miracle? Be the miracle. And, you know, it's kind of a silly movie and all, but that is a very deep sentence there. And I thought, man, that is just so true. I've seen it in life. And I'm living proof. I had no exceptional skills at everything or was gifted in some way or some brilliant person that knew what was going to all happen to me and how to get through it. No, I was completely terrified. And so when I look back on my life now, I go like, wow, with that perspective, I go, man, how did I do all that? And why? What was I thinking? But I really want to tell people it's the attitude's everything. And there's a lot of people in hospitals right now, you know, and I get emails all the time from people recovering from catastrophic injuries and diseases. And it's all about the attitude you get. And so often you see those little kids with cancer, or you see somebody with a tragic thing, and they have such a great attitude. It just warms your heart. And you go like, yeah, that person's going to be okay. They're going to be all right.
You know, Brian, real quick, if you just as an aside, because I've got random access, Brian, if you ever get a chance, look up Bobby Henline. He's a fellow we've had on the show before, and I think you might really relate to him. Brian, as you're out, not all of us get the kind of wake up that you got. And very often life interferes with living life. What can those of us who are just average Joes out there do to remind ourselves to pinch ourselves on a regular basis and say, look, really, what a miracle this is, and don't let fear stop you, and give it a try. What the heck? You're going to fall down more times, but you got to get back up again, and that's what it's about.
My answer is always stop, take a deep breath, take a time out, go out in nature, take a walk. If the best you can do to get in nature, go take a walk out in the field behind your house, do it. Just do it. Stand out there, feel the sun on your face for a minute. Go look at the stars at night just for 5 minutes. It's all around us every day. There's a daily miracle occurring right in your backyard every day. And just take that time out and go, okay, I need to gain a little perspective. The job, the mortgage, the traffic is all getting to me where I now believe that's real life. And that's not real life. Real life is you're spinning through the Milky Way on a tiny planet that'll someday be engulfed by the sun. So get that perspective. And you won't miss each moment. But for me, you just go out in nature, even for a short. And I spend a lot of time in nature with my bird photography. But for the average person, take a time out, boom, go out there, like I say, go look at go check out the meteor shower, you know, every August, or go to the beach, or just sit there and watch birds fly by. It's amazing how much it'll do for your overall mentality.
Brian, I know you're a highly paid professional, but if you wanted to motivate me by saying that my life is spinning into the sun to burn up, I guess different things work for different people.
Don't worry, you've got several billionaires.
Brian, we're down to just 2 minutes left, but what if there was one moment that was your favorite in the cockpit of the SR-71? Was it that time you turned off the cockpit lights and were almost blinded by the Milky Way? Was it the time you outran the Libyan missiles?
Nope, you already hit it. It's looking at the stars at night, turn the lights off just for that 30 seconds of unbelievable sight that I'll never see again, and breathtaking. Just hard to put in words. I spend probably 2 pages in the book trying to describe it, but I will tell you that humbled you, and if you ever wanted to gain perspective, boy, that was it. and it was a rare moment. I'm glad I took it. I'll never forget it.
Well, I tell you, I missed out on one thing on my bucket list. I've never seen an SR-71 take off before, or I should say heard it or felt it, and I probably won't. But I tell you, Brian, before I die, I sure would like to see the curvature of the Earth. I can't imagine something more comforting. And you talk about bringing a perspective than what you witnessed probably several times during your career.
Well, you may live to see space flight. I don't know. It may happen.
Well, I'll write a book like you, and then maybe I can afford to go up on one.
Just remember to take your camera.
Attaboy. Well, there you go. Take your camera. Brian, Major Brian Scholl, thank you so much. Again, folks, please visit sleddriver.com. Brian's got a lot of great stuff going on there, and you can support it, and just you'll learn a lot. Brian, thanks so much for spending some time with us here on American Warrior Radio.
Hey, thank you. I enjoyed it.
There you go, folks. You can find this podcast and others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, podcasts on Stitcher, Apple, Google, Deezer, wherever you find us. Please share these important messages. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. KVOI.